Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's an absolute pleasure to be back here again this year. Before I begin, I would just like to acknowledge the Gadigal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which we're meeting today. We're very lucky here in Australia to have First Nations people that protect our land and culture and hand it down to future generations. So I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present and to any First Nations people who are here with us today. So I'm going to be talking about productivity this morning. It certainly feels like the topic du jour. There has been lots of discussion about productivity growth over recent months, that it has slowed and how we as a country can reverse this. It's an extremely important issue, given the fundamental role that productivity growth has as a driver of rising living standards for Australians. And while these discussions, though, are critical for the economy, and they're very important to me as a private individual, as a central banker, my focus has to be on the implications of slower productivity growth for the economic outlook and for monetary policy settings. So to give that some framing, to achieve our mandate, that is sustaining low and stable inflation and a labour market at full employment, we need to understand what the economy will likely look like when we're at that point. So some features are pretty easy to identify, I think. For instance, we'd need to see inflation holding around the middle of the 2 to 3% target band. Other features, though, are not so obvious. And specifically for today, what does the trend pace of GDP growth look like? What would be consistent with sustaining inflation and an economy at full employment? And what influences this pace of trend pace of growth? Well, one of the key drivers is productivity growth, alongside population growth and people's decisions around participation in the labour market. So that is how many people want a job and how many hours they want to work on average. So understanding productivity growth is crucial to understanding the sustainable rate of growth in the economy. Now, to cut to the chase, in our latest statement of monetary policy, we published an in-depth chapter that outlined our reasons for downgrading our assumption for the pace of productivity growth. This means our assumption for the sustainable trend pace of GDP growth is now lower than we previously thought, and it's lower than it has been historically. And this new assumption is a key input into how we interpret actual GDP outcomes. Now, before I dive deeper into these questions, I thought it would be worth revisiting what economists actually mean by productivity, why it's important, and how it's been tracking in recent years. Put simply, productivity measures how much we produce with what we have, whether that's people, machinery, energy, or other resources. When productivity increases, we can produce more goods or services without requiring more inputs. Now, our economy becomes more productive when we find smarter ways to do things, and whether that's by improving how we allocate resources, investing in new skills or machines, or creating and adopting new technologies. A great example of the latter is the personal computer. I can tell you it would have taken me a lot longer to write this speech if I'd had to do it on a typewriter without the ability to easily delete, cut, and paste. That's a productivity improvement in action over the last 100 years or so. So why is productivity growth so important? Well, most fundamentally, it is a key driver of improvements in our living standards over the medium term. As productivity rises, it becomes cheaper to produce goods and services, and the economic pie grows as we can produce more with the scarce resources we have. Now, in the data that economists track, this improvement shows up as an increase in real incomes, which is a dollar value of the goods and services we can buy per hour worked after we strip out inflation. For example, in 1901, it took the average Australian 18 minutes of work to earn enough to buy a loaf of bread. Today, that average is just 4 minutes. So really quite substantial improvement in living standards and productivity. Now, you can see the lift in real incomes over a slightly shorter time period in this chart, and it really does track very closely to productivity growth. So when productivity rises, we produce and so earn more. This allows all of us to either consume more or work less and spend more time doing what we value most, or potentially both. In fact, Australians have used around about one quarter of the productivity gains since 1980 to work less and take more leisure time, with the rest, around three quarters, being banked as higher income and consumption. Another reason why productivity growth is important from a monetary policy perspective is that it affects both demand and potential supply in the economy. And the balance between these is ultimately what determines inflation. Productivity growth allows us to produce more than we could before, which means it expands the supply capacity of the economy. Now, this is a really important consideration for monetary policy because it means the economy can sustain a faster pace of growth in demand before it hits capacity constraints and inflation starts to rise. In this way, productivity growth determines the rate of growth the economy can sustain on an ongoing basis. But productivity growth also supports demand. When productivity and real incomes are growing strongly, households generally lift their spending, and businesses will have an incentive to invest to keep up with growing demand. Now, growth in living standards is, of course, important to us at the RBA. We have a mandate to support the economic welfare of the Australian people. And it's hard to argue that productivity growth is not a good outcome for the economy, given the role it plays in lifting living standards. But there's very little that central banks can do to directly influence productivity over the medium term, though this is an area of active research. So instead, our focus is on setting monetary policy to maintain price inflation stability and achieve full employment. And we think this will create the economic conditions that are conducive for investment and innovation to thrive. But as I've already outlined, understanding productivity dynamics in the economy is a really important factor that we need to be across to be able to make sound monetary policy decisions. So what's happened in terms of productivity growth recently? Well, I think it's now a pretty well-established statistical fact that productivity growth has slowed across many advanced economies, including Australia, since the mid-2000s. This trend has persisted in the post-pandemic period, with the notable exception of the US. In Australia, we think some sector-specific and likely temporary factors have weighed on aggregate productivity over the past 5 or so years. These include strong growth in the non-market sector's share of the economy, where measured productivity is relatively low, and sharp declines in productivity in the mining sector, possibly as some miners have tapped less productive deposits. But there are also broader factors at work, we think. Productivity growth has slowed in almost all sectors over the long run, as you can see in this chart. So what are the drivers of this broad-based slowdown? Well, the jury is still out, but Australian economic research, including analysis done by some of my colleagues at the RBA, has pointed to some key structural trends behind the Australian slowdown. Business and labour market dynamism has declined, meaning it takes longer now for capital and labour to move to higher productivity firms. Technological diffusion has also slowed, with Australian firms taking longer to catch up to the global technological frontier. And that's something we've actually seen in other advanced economies as well. Competition in the Australian economy appears to have declined, and indeed, this is one factor that we think has contributed to declining dynamism and slowing technological diffusion. In fact, joint work by staff at the RBA and Treasury suggests that returning to mid-2000s levels of competition could improve resource allocation and thereby raise productivity and the level of GDP by up to 3%. And capital deepening, which means the rate of increase in the amount of capital, so machinery, IT equipment and so on, per worker, is happening more slowly. Now, that said, this could be a symptom as well as a cause. A slower growth in productivity dampens returns to investment, and so, in theory, leads to slower capital deepening. So what has all of this meant for the Australian economy? Well, the first point to note is that the supply capacity of the economy, so that's what economists typically call potential output, has grown more slowly than it would have had the previous pace of productivity growth been maintained. Second, as productivity growth has slowed over the last 2 decades, Australian households and businesses have generally adjusted down their consumption, or the rate of growth of their consumption and investment spending, to match the lower sustainable pace of growth. Now, similar patterns have been evident overseas. In many countries, as I said, the pace of productivity growth has slowed recently. And generally speaking, the pace of growth of consumption per capita has matched this slowdown. And I'm capturing productivity here as GDP per capita. This has been the case for both strong productivity and weak productivity growth outcomes, or in other words, the correlation between these two looks pretty strong. So, what are the implications of this slowdown then for the outlook for the economy? Well, that brings me quite nicely to our own outlook and the recent downgrade that we've made to our productivity assumption. As we presented in our August SMP, for some time we had assumed that the weakness in productivity growth was temporary. This meant that we were effectively assuming that productivity growth was going to be higher than it ultimately turned out to be. Recognizing this and the evidence that at least part of the slowdown has reflected structural factors that are likely to persist, we downgraded our medium-term trend productivity growth assumption from 1% per annum to 0.7% in the August SMP. Now, it's worth emphasizing that this is an assumption about productivity growth for the next two or so years. It says nothing about the outlook over the longer term, which will be shaped by a broad range of developments, including the pace of diffusion of new technologies like AI. And consistent with this shorter time horizon, we will revisit this assumption regularly over time as the outlook for productivity changes. Now, the downgrade to our productivity growth assumption has important implications for our assessment of the pace of growth that can be sustained without generating inflationary pressures. Specifically, our new assumption implies that over the medium term, potential output is we now expect to grow at around 2% a year, rather than around 2.25%. Now, this is slower than the pace that we've seen in earlier decades, and that's because both population and productivity growth in those earlier times were stronger, as you can see on the chart here. The purple bar is mostly population, to help those in the audience. The impact of our revised productivity assumption on the outlook for the supply side of the economy and medium-term growth is, therefore, pretty clear, I think. What's less certain is how it could affect the balance between potential supply and demand, and hence the outlook for economic and activity and inflation in the near term over the next 2 years. As outlined in the August SMP, it looks like households and businesses have already internalized the slower productivity and income growth that has occurred in recent years. So the change in the assumption is us catching up with what's been happening on the ground. Given this, we downgraded our forecast for year-ended GDP growth by 0.3 percentage points by the end of our forecast horizon. So that's exactly in line with the downgrade to our forecast for potential output growth. And in doing so, we revised all components of GDP downward by roughly the same amount, although there are some differences. So what does all of this mean for our assessment of the outlook for the balance of potential supply and demand, and so inflation? Well, in the wash-up, very little. The productivity downgrade has no effect on our assessment of the current balance of demand and supply, as this is based on recent and past data, and so already innately captures slowing productivity growth. The revision also doesn't change our view on the future balance over our two-year forecast horizon. Our August SMP forecasts still had consumption and GDP growth picking up, but by a bit less than we previously expected. The gap between demand and supply still closed gradually, with inflation returning and holding at around about the midpoint of the target range. Where the revision does matter, though, is for how we interpret the actual data we receive moving forward from here. In the past, when potential growth was around about 2.5% to 3% a year, quarterly GDP growth of around 0.5%, which would be equivalent to an annual growth rate of around 2%, would have been seen as subdued, below trend. It would have suggested that demand was growing slower than growth in supply capacity, and in which case inflationary pressures would have been easing. But with our new lower potential output assumption, that same rate of GDP growth would now signal demand and capacity growing largely in line with each other, and inflationary pressures holding steady. I'll return to this later in the context of our current forecast for the outlook and the most recent national accounts data. But before that, one important dimension of the downgrade to our productivity growth assumption that I haven't touched on yet is its implications for the labor market. Now, lower productivity growth doesn't really affect our outlook for the balance of demand and supply capacity in the labor market. And so it doesn't really have an impact on our forecast for things like employment growth and the unemployment rate. but it does have implications for the outlook for wages growth. Ultimately, productivity growth is the determinant of sustainable real wages growth, as it allows nominal wages to increase without leading to a build-up in inflationary pressures. So while real wages can grow more quickly than productivity for a period without necessarily driving up inflation, over the long run, productivity growth underpins the rate of real wages growth. It follows then that the long run rate of annual nominal wages growth that is consistent with our dual mandate, so that's inflation at target and the labor market at full employment, equals the midpoint of the inflation target range, so 2.5%, plus the rate of productivity growth, which we now assume is 0.7%. So the productivity downgrade lowers our assessment of this rate from around about 3.5% a year to around 3.2% when you look at the holistic measure of wages that comes out of the national accounts, as average earnings in the national accounts for the aficionados. Unfortunately, the productivity growth plus 2.5% rule does not work as neatly for the wage price index due to the way that series is constructed. The equivalent calculation for the WPI would suggest a rate slightly below 3%, but you've really got to interpret that with a bit more caution. Now, it's important to note that this does not suggest that wages growth that is above these levels for a period will necessarily drive up inflation or preclude a period of real wage catch-up that allows workers to recoup previous declines in real wages. Indeed, the August SNP forecast includes a projection for wages growth that exceeds these rates in the near term, while inflation remains close to the midpoint of the target range. But the productivity growth plus 2.5% rule of thumb does provide a useful guide to what rate of nominal wages growth could be sustained in the long run, when the economy is sustainably and persistently at full employment. This again underscores the importance of productivity growth in driving ongoing improvements in living standards for Australians. Now, to finish, I thought I'd talk about some of the risks around our forecasts and maybe start with the observation that from a monetary policy standpoint, our August SNP forecasts look pretty good. We expected inflation to stay around the midpoint of the target band over the next 2 years and for labour market conditions to remain broadly stable, with employment growth tracking underlying population growth. But of course, as always, there were material risks on both sides of that central projection, as we set out in the August SNP and as I've discussed in previous speeches. One such set of risks stems from the outlook for productivity. Our revised assumption for productivity growth may still be too high. The revision implies that productivity growth picks back up to its current 20-year average as some of the temporary drags wane. But this is no certainty. On the flip side, it's also possible that our new assumption is too low, particularly if the diffusion of technologies like AI occurs more quickly than many expect, or if some of the other longer-term structural impediments unwind. If productivity growth and therefore the economy's potential output turns out to be different to our assumption in either direction, the effect on inflation would then hinge on the extent to which demand adjusts. In this sense, inflation outcomes can provide an important gauge on how these dynamics and risks are playing out. So, how has the recent data that we've had since August fitted in with our forecasts? Well, if anything, outcomes have been a little bit stronger than those than what we were expecting. In the most recent national accounts, GDP growth picked up to be 1.8% over the year to the June quarter, slightly above our forecasts. Historically, this would have seemed a little bit slow, but given our now lower assessment of medium-term potential GDP growth, this outcome was actually broadly consistent with demand and potential supply growing at a similar pace. At the same time, the high-frequency data suggests that underlying inflation in the September quarter could well be a bit stronger than we anticipated. Now, this may suggest that the labour market and economic conditions more generally remain a bit tighter than we had assessed, and we're actively analysing this question ahead of our next set of forecasts, which will be released in just a few weeks at the start of November. At the same time, employment growth has slowed by slightly more than we were expecting, and uncertainty about the global outlook does remain elevated. So, given these signs that private demand is recovering and indications that inflation may be persistent in some areas,
The board decided that it was appropriate to maintain the cash rate at its current level at the September meeting. Looking forward, we're going to be monitoring outcomes and continually reassessing our view on the outlook for the economy. And the board will adjust policy as appropriate as new information comes to hand. Thank you. I look forward to taking some questions.
Thank you, Sarah. Informative as always. I think this time last year we were talking about inflation, which obviously has been topical over the last 12 months, referenced many times in your presentation. I guess as you reflect back to us sitting on stage this time last year to where we are today, any sort of thoughts you want to share with us? I guess, you know, from my point of view, I heard you say that we're pretty close or within the band of inflation. But I think households are still experiencing high prices. Mm-hmm. Inflation, you know, tends to look a little over that inflation band that you discussed. So, you know, how are you thinking about that? And when do you think that, what can households and us all expect going forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think when I was here a year ago, I was talking about inflation expectations and how important it was to us to keep them anchored and how pleased we were that that seemed to be the case. I'm very pleased to be able to say that still looks like it's the case. We don't see any signs that they're becoming de-anchored. And in terms of actual inflation, our forecast a year ago, we were expecting and obviously hoping that we'd continue to see underlying inflation. So we measure that through trim mean, to continue to moderate through this year and to be approaching, to be inside the target band by this point and then certainly approaching the midpoint by the end of the year. It's very pleasing to see that that has generally played out. We obviously had trim mean inflation at 2.7% for the June quarter. But we are monitoring and we're always looking and seeing how things are developing. And in the latest monthly indicator prints, what we have seen is that a couple of the components that we monitor very closely, where you can get a good read from that monthly indicator, they have come through a touch stronger. So the governor mentioned housing inflation and market services. And so those are particular watch points for us. And I think the key question from here is making sure what we want to try and do from here, obviously, is keep inflation more or less where it is now and in an underlying sense, around about that 2.5%, the midpoint of the target band. So that's why we're going to be monitoring risks to both sides, of course. But in the latest data in particular, we've seen it come through a touch higher.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. I'm going to ask one more question. I think there's going to be a ton of questions out there in the room. I'm particularly interested in just asking a little question about AI and productivity. Obviously, you know, we've heard here over the last 24 hours a lot of AI discussion in every topic pretty much. You referenced AI or emerging technologies in your address. How are you incorporating the impact of these potential emerging technologies into your forecasting? What timeframes do you think we're likely to see AI or any technological gains coming through?
Yeah, excellent questions. And it's a really, it's very much an emerging, nascent question. So I'm not going to pretend like I have the answer to these things or that we have a crystal ball back in the office that we can rub and know for sure. We're thinking about it in terms of looking at historical experience with a generalist technology like this. And a couple of observations from history are, one, it does take some time. So it's unlikely to sort of all erupt and emerge in the next 3 to 6 months. We think it'll take a little bit longer than that. And that two, the technological gains can potentially come in almost waves. We first use the technology and that gives us some uplift. Then we work out how to use it better and that gives another uplift down the track. And so it could well take a number of years for these things to flow through. My final observation is that if you look through history, each sort of big generalist technology that's emerged and then been adopted, the speed of adoption has generally increased over time. So it took a lot less time for the internet to become well established than it did for electrification, for example. I don't know, but it certainly feels like this time is moving pretty quickly again. So perhaps, you know, we're not talking decades and decades, but I think we probably are talking years. And that's why we're very conscious that this change to our productivity assumption, we're very much thinking about it as our view for the next couple of years. We will revisit this because I think even in 2 years' time, we'll know a lot more about the impact AI is having here and around the world. And then we'll have to look to potentially change that assumption in one direction or another. So it's certainly not a set and forget.
Yeah, so remaining patient, I guess, and observing what is happening out there and proactive around integrating those into your forecasts.
And actually rolling out this technology for ourselves within the bank. So how do we actually make use of it, and how does it improve what we do, the quality of the analysis and the breadth of that we can give to the board?
As a bank, we're also going through the same process. I might throw to the floor. I've got a ton more questions, as I said, but we've got the opportunity now to ask your questions of Sarah. So we'll start down here.
Had that signal before from the data, and it turned out to not be the case. And then I'm also reminded of the US, which I think has quite high quality inflation data and has obviously had, it started this year, a bit of a high inflation scare, but it's ended up being quite moderate. So, how do you think about those signal to noise judgments in the context of what I think to be, no disrespect to the ABS, but I think that the US data is probably higher quality than the Australian data, at least at this moment in time. So, and I guess it, just to tie up the question, it does seem like an unusual place to end an easing cycle with the unemployment rate trending up and policy a little bit restrictive. So maybe you can fold that into your judgments about the inflation pulse.
Yeah, no, great question. So I suppose to start on the, could we be head faked by the inflation numbers. Look, that's always something that's on our mind. The fundamental of any type of analysis of any given data point is how much is signal and how much is noise. And so we dig into all of the series to really try and understand that. And obviously you do have to make some judgments about that too. If you knew precisely, there wouldn't be this risk. We wouldn't have to worry about it. In terms of the latest data and our read of it and our sense of it, so we, particularly with the monthly CPI indicator, we really don't look at the aggregate indices that are published, so that's the headline series, but and also the monthly trim mean. That's because the coverage is incomplete and the various other challenges there. We really do focus on the components where they give a genuine read. So that's why month one, you get less information because it's less complete. Month two is a good month because you get market services, and that's for the quarter, not just for that month. Our read of the data is looking at those components where we have at least more confidence than in others that the 2 months together are giving us some signal. But could we see a bit of a drop back down in the December quarter, for instance, that there's some one-off temporary factors in there? Absolutely, we're not discounting that fact, and obviously we're working through that at the moment in the context of our November forecast. So you'll see where we land up in all of that in a few weeks' time. In terms of thinking about that and in the context of restrictiveness of policy and those sorts of questions, I think the key question for us really in terms of policy setting is what are the outcomes that we think we're going to achieve over the 1 to 2 year horizon? So you've heard this from many central bankers, I'm sure. Monetary policy acts with a lag. So we're not influencing the data that we get today. Well, clearly not, because that was from backward looking anyway. But beyond that, we're not really having much of an impact on the economy in the very near term, the 3 to 6 months. It's only in the 12 to 18 month horizon that whatever decision is made today has an impact. So we're always forward looking, and our assessment and our advice to the board in terms of the policy settings is looking ahead to that point in time. So whether we think we have to be stay a little bit restrictive or change that is really a function of what we think the economy is going to look like in 12 months. And that's really the key judgment for us in terms of that policy advice. Final comment on that is that I often get asked about neutral. What's the neutral rate for the cash rate? How quickly are you going to get there? Those sorts of things. Any estimate for neutral, number one, incredibly wide error bounds. It's an incredibly hard thing to estimate. And number two, it's a long-run concept that takes that looks through, if you like, all of the shocks and shifts and everything else that might be playing out at any given point in time. Of course, at any given point in time, there are always shocks and shifts running through the economy, and today is no different. And so neutral is only ever a guide. It's sort of up there at the top. It is not the anchor point for actual policy setting.
Do we have another question from the floor? Microphone down the front. Thank you.
Arguably, interest rates before COVID were far too low. And, of course, they got to very low levels in Australia and elsewhere. What do you think central banks, including the Reserve Bank, learned from that period? And what do you think is, I mean, we used to read the textbooks that you had a zero bound on interest rates, but, you know, that was proven not to be true. But what do you think is a sort of a lower bound on interest rates in the future?
Oh, look, it's a good question. It comes a little bit back to the question around neutral and what is neutral. But I think more generally, rates were low and then went to the zero lower bound during COVID. That was clearly an exceptional time where all arms of policy were providing exceptional support to the economy. I would never discount the risk that we end up with another such event that requires that type of support. So I would never say that we won't go back to the zero lower bound. I think you always have to prepare for those very, very bad outcomes, and they can materialise in the future. And colleagues in the financial markets group at the bank are always looking at what monetary policy implementation looks like if we did have that very bad outcome. So I guess there's one part to your question. In terms of where interest rates are now and what is neutral now compared to pre-COVID, that is very, very hard to know. Different models will give you very, very different answers to that question. That was my point around the error bands around these models are really wide. So I don't have a definitive answer for you. The best answer that we will ever get is what we observe happening in reality to interest rates, but then also to economic outcomes. That's ultimately going to tell us where neutral is, but where it is today precisely, I don't know. I can't tell you that, and most central bankers will say the same. We don't know. If it was that easy, the job would be a lot easier. Unfortunately, it's not.
Thank you. Bring it back to productivity. You mentioned that we've seen productivity growth slowing since the mid-2000s. There are a number of factors, I guess, that you called out there. Technology lag here versus in the rest of the world, competition decline. What can Australian businesses do beyond what government can do to improve productivity in the private sector?
Oh, what a question. If there was an easy answer to that question, I think we'd all be doing it already. And we wouldn't be talking about it and trying to work it out today. I think what's interesting for an economy like Australia, and I mentioned some of the research that my colleagues at the bank have done on this, is that we are a small open economy, relatively small in the grand scheme of things. And so diffusion of new technologies that may be coming in from overseas is particularly important. It's very hard for us to break new ground right across all sectors of the economy because of our size and scale. We're just not that big. So diffusion is really important. And so thinking about how we bring in and propagate through the economy new technologies, I think, is going to be pretty critical. But beyond that, and to the specifics for specific businesses, I think that's pretty tricky to completely work through. And to be honest with you, it's not an area that we at the bank focus on. It's not our core mandates. The Productivity Commission and others have got lots and lots to say on that, so I would always send people in that direction.
Thank you. Another question over here? In the middle there.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. I just had a question around Q2 consumption data was obviously quite strong, but people were calling out a lot of one-off factors within that data. Are you able to talk about how you've seen Q3 consumption data tracking so far and whether that's sort of as you expect or and how you're thinking about that going forward?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Consumption data at the moment definitely looks like it's being impacted by seasonal shifts. So we're getting these very strong December quarters that we think are related to Black Friday, and then you get a softer March quarter, and then there's potentially a less sort of severe, if you like, version of that for the June quarter with the end of financial year sales and that sort of thing. Timing of school holidays can have an impact too. So we are aware of that. And also, of course, running through the consumer spending numbers at the moment is the timing of the end of electricity rebates. And sorry, this is a technical point, but when that happens in a national accounts measurement perspective, the payment for the consumption of electricity transfers back from government to households. So that's another additional challenge to work through at the moment. In terms of the latest data for the September quarter, so with all of that, we were actually expecting maybe momentum might soften a bit just from some of these technical adjustments, really, so not in a fundamental sense, but in an adjustment sense. The data hasn't been too surprising for us, so we've certainly not been surprised on the downside with it. It's a bit choppy, as it always is, and that monthly spending indicator that we get from the ABS is still new, and so we're still learning about it. I think everybody is. But yeah, we certainly haven't been this surprised on the downside by what we've seen, but obviously we'll find out in a couple of months' time how it plays out.
Paul?
Thanks, Sarah, for your comments. I just wanted to explore a little bit further the point about lags in monetary policy. One thing that we know already is that house prices have responded quite promptly to the easing so far. And that presumably means that sort of down the track, and to this earlier, to the previous question, consumer spending is going to pick up. So through a number of channels. So just interested in your thoughts around, you know, how you're thinking about this sort of transmission mechanism, particularly through the housing market.
Yes, so the housing market, the established market, so house prices effectively, it's the first and one of the most responsive parts of the domestic economy in terms of monetary policy transmission. So we're obviously tracking what's happening in that market and with house prices. It's sort of in line with what we've seen in previous easing cycles, so we're not surprised there's been a pickup. We've seen that before. You know, we do understand why from a cyclical sense. We're obviously lower interest rates increase people's borrowing capacity, and then that naturally flows through. So we're not surprised that that's happening. We're certainly tracking it. It's not out of line with what we've seen in previous cycles, but obviously there's always a lot of other things running through that market at any given point in time, and that's certainly something we're going to be focused on moving forward. I think what's where you do get the sort of lag starting to materialise in terms of economic activity and actual inflation outcomes, because obviously house prices are not in the inflation basket, is in via, as you mentioned, consumption, but also dwelling construction. And that does take a bit of time. You know, if you're going to build your own home, even a detached home, you've got to get the approvals, you've got to get the work underway, and that takes a number of months. If we're talking about high-density housing construction, that can take years to sort of get it off the ground and fully make it through to completion. So that's the kind of lag that I'm talking about when I'm talking on a 12, 18, even 24-month horizon. But no, we're certainly monitoring it, and we're not surprised that we've seen a pickup, and it's certainly something that we'll be paying attention to, how much of a pickup and how much continues from here in terms of the outlook.
Thanks, Paul. We've probably got time for one more question over here.
Thanks, Dr. Hunter, for your speech. Stephanie from the ABC. Sorry to bring up the topic, but you mentioned uncertainty, and obviously a major source of uncertainty is the US trade war, and we've seen some reignition of tensions between China and the US in the recent week. How much is that factoring into the difficulty around forecasting? You know, you said your August forecasts were pretty good, but given this is now dragging on for a significant amount of time, what challenges is that creating? And I guess, what have you seen so far in terms of the balance of risks around, you know, inflation and growth risks?
Yeah, it's certainly an unpredictable situation to be dealing with. You know, we're still in a phase seemingly where we wake up at the start of the day and there's another fairly major announcement come through. Certainly my China team and my international team more broadly are getting a real workout at the moment. They're working very hard on this, and it is pretty challenging. And the latest sort of escalation is obviously still pretty new as well. So we are, as everyone is, I think, still working it through. So I don't have definitive answers for you. We'll obviously take a view when we come to November in our next forecast. But just generally speaking, what we've seen historically time and again is that uncertainty does drag on the outlook. It makes it very hard for businesses to make decisions, in particular around investment. It can be pretty challenging for consumers as well. If you're concerned that you might be at risk of losing your job or what have you, then that can dampen your spending too. What we've seen in the data through to now, I think, is that there's some of that maybe coming through in the US, around their labor market data in particular. We're seeing less evidence of that here in Australia, and we can ask in our liaison program, for instance, what decisions might be delayed as a result of uncertainty. We're not really hearing too much of that at the moment. We're not seeing too much of an impact in the business surveys, for instance. But we are very watchful of it, and mindful of it. We've been calling it out in the last two S&P sets of forecasts, and we'll certainly have more to say in November. It's a very unpredictable situation, and that does make it challenging.
Thank you, Sarah. Please join. We're out of time, unfortunately, but she spared the question I was going to ask on CBDC and stablecoins, so we'll save that for another day. But please join me in thanking Sarah for her time here this morning.
Thank you.